Welcome back to the deep dive. I was actually standing in line for coffee this morning, and I was just mindlessly scrolling through Twitter.
Oh, always a dangerous game before caffeine.
Right. Such a bad habit.
Yeah.
But I'm switching from that to a news app, then over to a text thread with my family. And I just had this sudden, like, this visceral moment of vertigo.
Vertigo, like physically dizzy.
Yeah, literally dizzy. And it wasn't just that whole too much information thing. It was this really sinking feeling that everyone I was reading, everyone I was talking to was living in a completely different reality.
Wow, yeah.
And I don't mean just having different opinions. I mean existing in totally different worlds.
I mean, that is sort of the defining nausea of the modern age, isn't it? We have access to more data than literally any humans in history, yet we seem to have way less shared ground.
Exactly.
We're basically drowning in content, but we are absolutely starving for truth.
Drowning in content, starving for truth. That is exactly what we are unpacking today. We're looking at a huge stack of research on two absolute titans of philosophy who essentially dedicated their lives to fixing that exact broken feeling.
Edmund Husserl and Martin Heidegger.
Yes. Yeah. Husserl and his student, who, spoiler alert, eventually becomes his rival Heidegger. And I have to say, going through this source material, this plays out almost like a drama.
Oh, it completely does.
It's not just dry academic theory. It feels like a battle for the soul of reality itself.
It really is a generational conflict. You have the teacher who desperately wants to save this idea, absolute truth, and the student who basically comes in and says, burn it down. I need to look at what existence even is instead.
But before we get to the messy breakup, we should probably set the stage. Because why were they so obsessed with truth in the first place? Looking at the historical context, the late 19th century wasn't exactly a chill time for intellectuals.
Not at all. They were writing entirely in the shadow of Friedrich Nietzsche. And if you think your Twitter feed is chaotic, I mean, Nietzsche was the original disruptor.
Right, the God is dead guy.
Exactly. But his attack on truth was actually a lot more specific than just that. He argued that what we call truth isn't some shiny, objective object just waiting out there in the world to be discovered.
So what is it then?
He thought it was just an expression of our will to power.
Okay, so if I say, you know, it's wrong to lie, Nietzsche wouldn't say, yes, that is a moral fact.
No, he'd say, that's just you being weak and needing to invent a rule to protect yourself from people who are stronger.
Wow. Everything is biological or just emotional.
Precisely. And then on top of Nietzsche, you had the rise of this movement called psychologism, led by thinkers like Wilhelm Dilthey.
Oh, like Dilthey.
Yeah. And they were essentially arguing that our worldviews are just the direct result of our psychological types.
So if you have a highly rational brain and I have a more emotional brain, our so-called truths are just different flavors of ice cream.
Exactly. There's no objectively right flavor.
Which implies that absolutely everything is relative. There is no bedrock at all. And from the sources, that idea drove Edmund Husserl absolutely insane.
It genuinely terrified him. Husserl looked at that creeping relativism and he basically saw the end of science itself.
How so?
Well, he said, look, if everything is just psychology, if logic is just how the human brain happens to be wired, then 2 + 2 = 4 isn't an eternal truth. It's just a biological habit of the human species.
Oh, I see. And he just couldn't accept that.
No. He wanted to build what he called a rigorous science of the spirit. He was desperately searching for a foundation that was completely universal, absolute, and unshakable.
He wanted to stop the sliding. So he decides to go all the way back to the original doubter, René Descartes.
Yes, that classic starting point.
Most of you probably know Descartes for I think, therefore I am.
Mm-hmm.
He sat there and doubted absolutely everything until he found the one single thing he couldn't doubt, which was the fact that he was currently thinking. But here is where the notes get really spicy. Husserl basically thought Descartes was a quitter.
Well, quitter might be a slightly harsh word, but yeah, he absolutely thought Descartes was not nearly radical enough.
Wait, how can you possibly be more radical than doubting the existence of the universe?
Well, look closely at what Descartes actually does. He gets to, I think, and then he immediately jumps to, I am a thinking thing.
A soul.
Right, a soul, a substance. And Husserl just screams, stop, you've already made a massive assumption.
Because he called it a thing.
Exactly. As soon as you label it a thing, you are dragging in a concept from the very physical world that you're supposed to be doubting.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, so Husserl wants to go back behind the label.
Mm.
He wants to find the pure I before we even slap the word self on it.
Yes, and this brings us directly to his famous method, phenomenology, and specifically this core tool he developed called Epoche.
Or bracketing.
Right, bracketing. And we really need to be careful here because this gets misunderstood constantly.
Yeah, I'll admit, when I first read about bracketing, I thought, okay, so I just ignore the physical world.
Right.
I pretend my coffee cup isn't sitting right there. Because that honestly sounds like a recipe for walking directly into traffic.
No, absolutely not. It has nothing to do with ignoring reality. No. Bracketing isn't doubting that the world exists like some cynical skeptic.
Okay.
It's entirely about suspending your judgment about it. You're sure. Putting your theories, your scientific labels, all your daily assumptions into brackets, just setting them aside momentarily so you can look at the raw, unfiltered data of consciousness exactly as it appears to you.
Let's ground this for a second.
Yeah.
I am looking at this microphone right in front of me. My brain instantly downloads a file that says, electronic device made of metal amplifies sound for recording. Husserl wants me to just hit mute on that entire commentary.
Hit mute, exactly. Strip away what he calls the natural attitude. All those mundane assumptions like, this is a tool I use for work.
Okay, done.
Now, if you successfully bracket all of that, what do you actually lift with?
Just the visual, the silver curve, the way the studio light hits the grill, just this raw sensation of objectness, I guess.
Yes. He is trying to isolate the universal structure of consciousness that even allows you to experience the microphone in the first place.
So he's looking for the lens itself, not the picture that the lens is taking.
That is a fantastic way to put it. He calls this ultimate lens the transcendental ego.
Which honestly sounds like a psychedelic rock band from the 70s.
It really does. But for Husserl, it's deadly serious business. It refers to the pure eye that is identical in every single human being.
Not me with my specific memories and my coffee addiction.
Right. Not the empirical you. The pure structural subjectivity. Husserl firmly believed that if we could accurately describe this pure consciousness, we would finally have that universal foundation for all human knowledge.
Okay, but I do have to push back here a little bit. Why does any of this actually matter? Because sitting here, it feels like we are just peeling an onion until there is absolutely nothing left in our hands. What do we actually gain by finding this transcendental ego?
We gain certainty. That was always the ultimate prize for Husserl. If we can completely understand the basic structure of the eye, we can finally understand how knowledge itself happens. And that leads directly to that really key metaphor mentioned in the source material, the hyphen.
The hyphen, yes. Yeah.
Think about traditional physical science. It studies the object rocks, stars, cells.
Yep.
Then think about introspection or psychology. It studies the subject feelings, brain states. Husserl says both sides have completely missed the point. We shouldn't be studying the subject or the object in isolation. We need to study the connection between them. The hyphen in the phrase, I know something.
Because you can never actually have the I floating around without the something.
Exactly correct.
Yeah.
This is his defining concept of intentionality.
Which is a term he borrowed from medieval philosophy, right?
He did, but he totally upgraded it. He gave it a superpower. Husserl argues that consciousness is quite literally never empty. You are never just thinking in a void. You are always thinking about something.
So consciousness is inherently directional.
Yes. It is an arrow constantly pointing out at the world.
That is a huge shift from the old blank slate idea, like John Locke back in the day, thinking the mind is just this passive bucket that catches whatever sensory data happens to fall into it.
It's a massive shift. Husserl, and he's really following Immanuel Kant here, says, no way. The mind is fiercely active. It doesn't just receive static pictures like a camera. It constitutes the object.
Constitutes. That's a heavy academic word.
Yeah.
And make it sound almost like I'm hallucinating my own reality.
Not hallucinating. Synthesizing.
Yeah.
Think about that microphone again. From where you're sitting, you only actually see the front side of it.
Right.
But your mind automatically fills in the back, the hollow inside, the weight of the metal. It effortlessly creates a full 3D object in your mind.
Oh, I see.
You are actively stitching those fragmentary data points into a single coherent thing. You give it meaning.
So we aren't passive security cameras just recording the world. We are active directors, editing the movie in real time.
We are co-creators of our reality.
Honestly, that is super empowering. But also, I don't know, a little exhausting. And it seems like Husserl himself eventually felt that exhaustion too. Because looking at the notes, towards the end of his life, he makes a pretty major pivot.
He does. He slowly realizes that this whole theoretical attitude, this intense staring at the world like a detached scientist bracketing everything, is ultimately artificial.
Because we don't live in a sterile laboratory.
Exactly. We live in the mess. We live in the dirt and the noise.
He calls it the Lebenswelt, right? The life world.
The Lebenswelt. The pre-theoretical world, the ordinary everyday world where we just exist, where we use tools without thinking, talk to our friends, and just deal with daily problems. Husserl finally realized that all his high-minded, rigorous science is actually built entirely on top of this messy, unexamined, lived experience.
And that late career realization basically unlocks the door for his star student, Martin Heidegger, to just walk right in and blow the entire building up.
Enter Heidegger. This is where the real philosophical drama happens. Heidegger takes a hard look at Husserl's life project, this desperate attempt to strip the mind bare and find the perfect detached eye. And he basically says, it's a fantasy. You literally cannot do it.
But why not? If I can successfully bracket my assumptions about my coffee cup, why can't I bracket my assumptions about myself?
Because Heidegger argues that you can never fully bracket the world simply because you are never just looking at the world from the outside. You are always already in it. You are marinated in it.
Oh, it's like that comparison to David Hume in the research, where Hume basically told Descartes, look, I never catch myself without a perception. Like, you can't find the eye floating in a dark void.
Right.
So Heidegger is essentially telling his old teacher Husserl, you never catch the hyphen without the object.
Precisely. You cannot separate the dancer from the dance. Heidegger just isn't interested in how we know things anymore, epistemology. He wants to know about being itself ontology. And to do that, he introduces his most famous, notoriously untranslatable term, Dasein.
Dasein. Which literally just translates to being there.
Right. It refers specifically to human existence. Because we are the only beings who actually stop and ask questions about our own existence. We are fundamentally being in the world.
So instead of sitting in a quiet room thinking about the mechanics of thinking, Heidegger wants to analyze what it actually feels like to exist, the real texture of it. And to do this, he breaks existence down into these universal structures called existentialia.
Yes.
Which, I'm sorry, sounds like a skin condition. But stick with us here.
It does sound clinical, but it's actually incredibly visceral when you get into it. Take one of his most famous concepts, facticity or thrownness. Geworfenheit in German.
Thrownness. I actually love that image. But it sounds kind of violent.
It is violent. Think about it for a second. Did you choose your parents?
Definitely not.
Did you choose your genetic makeup? Did you choose to be born in the age of the internet with social media and climate change?
No, obviously not.
No. You were quite literally thrown into this highly specific movie right in the middle of the second act, entirely without a script.
Man, that explains so much of that underlying anxiety we started the show with, the vertigo.
Yeah.
We're playing a high-stakes game where we didn't even agree to the rules.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We are cast into a situation not of our making. And Heidegger asks the central question, how do we actually cope with that terrifying lack of control?
Well, just looking at my own daily life, I cope by staying incredibly busy.
Right. And Heidegger says that is a universal human response. We deal with thrownness by treating absolutely everything around us as tools to get things done. He calls this Vorhanden sein, or being ready to hand.
Okay, ready to hand.
We don't stare at a hammer and deeply contemplate its hammerness. We just grab it and use it to hit a nail. The tool is practically invisible to us while we're working.
Right, till the hammer actually breaks.
Yes. When the tool fails, when the internet suddenly goes down, or your car won't start in the morning, the flow stops abruptly. And suddenly we stare at the object. We become acutely aware of it as a physical thing in our way.
That makes total sense.
But he maps out other deep structures too. There's Mitzing, being with. Because we are fundamentally relational creatures, we exist alongside others. But the big one, the heavy one that truly shapes us, is being unto death.
Ah, here is the cheery part of the deep dive.
I know it sounds terribly morbid, but for Heidegger, death is the engine of all meaning. We are the only animal that is acutely aware it has a hard expiration date.
True.
That realization creates a profound urgency. It's what gives our life a narrative arc.
I guess that's true. If we live forever, nothing would really matter because we could just put everything off. You know, I'll finally write that novel in a million years.
Exactly. Death is the boundary that gives life its stakes. It frames our entire existence. And this leads to the ultimate aha moment in Heidegger's philosophy. The source material highlights this massive question he asks. Why is there something rather than nothing?
That is the big one.
Hmm.
But let's be real. We don't exactly walk around pondering that in the produce aisle at the grocery store.
No, we don't feel the weight of that cosmic question when we are busy using tools and coping. We only feel it in rare moments of profound, sweeping anxiety. Angst.
Wait, distinguish that from really quickly. Is angst different from just being stressed out about a deadline at work?
Completely different. Stress or fear is always about something specific. A deadline, a scary dog, a medical bill.
Okay.
Angst is about nothing. It's the sheer feeling of the ground dropping out from underneath you. It's that 3 a.m. staring at the ceiling realization that the universe didn't actually have to exist, and neither did you. It's facing the void.
It sounds absolutely terrifying. Why on earth would we want to go there?
Because Heidegger says that in that specific moment of dread, when all your daily busy work and distractions completely fall away, the true nature of being actually reveals itself to you.
So you stop being a robot just blindly using tools?
Yes. You start being an authentic human being, genuinely confronting your own existence.
So the anxiety isn't a glitch in the system. It's a wake-up call.
In the best case scenario, yes.
This actually brings us to what I think is the most mind-bending part of these sources. Heidegger's complete redefinition of truth itself. Because if he's right, if we are just thrown into a world and scrambling to cope with tools, then truth isn't just some scientific fact you memorize from a textbook.
No, not at all. The traditional view of truth for centuries was correspondence.
Right.
I have thought, the cat is on the mat. If I look and the cat is actually there, boom, that's truth. It's a simple matching game.
Seems logical enough.
Heidegger says that is way too shallow. He goes all the way back to the ancient Greek word for truth. Aletheia.
Aletheia.
Yes. It's derived from the word lethe, which means hidden or forgotten, like the river Lethe in Greek mythology. And the A at the beginning is an alpha privative, a negative, like in the word amoral.
So aletheia literally means unhiddenness or unconcealment.
Exactly. Unhiddenness.
So truth isn't a static, boring fact. It's an event, a reveal.
Think of it like a clearing in a very dense, dark forest. Truth isn't the trees themselves, it's the sudden light breaking through. It's a moment of disclosure. Or think about when you have a real moment of truth in a personal relationship.
Oh, yeah.
It's not that you suddenly calculated a new statistic about your partner. It's that something vital was hidden and suddenly the rock was rolled away and you saw the stark reality underneath. That is aletheia.
I really love that. That feels so much closer to how we actually experience life.
Yeah.
But I do have to ask, doesn't this lead us into some pretty tricky territory? Because if truth is suddenly all about my personal engagement with the world, my specific reveal, doesn't that make everything purely subjective again? The source material actually calls Heidegger the grandfather of postmodernism.
He absolutely is. And you are totally right to be skeptical here. Because if understanding the world is an active project, if we are thrown into a mess and just have to desperately make sense of it to survive, then understanding is really just projection.
Projection. Meaning I'm basically projecting my own survival needs onto the physical world.
Yes. To understand something is to make it an object for me. We survive by naming things, by aggressively categorizing them. The source text puts it quite bluntly. We survive by giving things meaning that suits us.
Wow.
We don't look at a forest and see trees in themselves. We see lumber to build a house or shade to hide under. We only see what matters to our specific existence.
That is a deeply haunting thought.
Yep.
It heavily implies that we are completely trapped in our own interpretations.
Yeah.
We never actually see the thing in itself. We just see our own reflection constantly staring back at us.
It is haunting, definitely. Okay. But Heidegger does offer a tiny glimmer of connection through this concept he calls the concrete universal.
Okay, you're going to have to help me with that one. Universal usually implies something big and vague. Concrete means highly specific. It sounds like a total oxymoron.
It does. Usually when we think of a universal human experience like love or grief or anxiety, we think of it as an average of everyone's feelings, like a statistic.
Right.
But Heidegger, and he's borrowing a bit from Hickel's playbook here, says the universal is not a broad statistic. It only ever appears within the highly specific individual.
Okay, so my specific hyper-individual experience of anxiety, that literal gnawing feeling in my stomach right now, that isn't just my weird personal quirk. That is the universal human condition physically manifesting inside of me.
Precisely. You cannot find humanity by looking at a demographic chart or reading a census. You only find it by looking deeply, unflinchingly into the eye. The universal lives entirely inside the particular.
So in a strange way, diving headfirst into our own personal specific messiness is really the only way to touch something universally real.
That is the ultimate paradox. You have to go entirely inward to get out.
Man, this has been quite a journey. We started with Husserl, trying to turn the human mind into this perfect sterile lab, trying to bracket out the entire noisy world just to find the pure ego.
A very noble failure.
And then Heidegger takes those exact same tool phenomenology and says, forget the lab. Let's go out to the graveyard. Let's go to the dirty construction site. He uses the method to explore the raw anxiety, the thrownness, and the terrifying time-bound nature of just simply existing.
And in doing so, he radically shifted philosophy away from asking, how do we know things, to asking, what does it actually mean to be?
So for you listening right now, who's probably just trying to get through your Tuesday, scrolling through your phone and feeling that exact vertigo we talked about at the top of the show, why does all this dense philosophy matter?
It matters because it fundamentally challenges us to look at how we constantly construct our reality. We aren't passive observers just taking in facts. We are actively constituting our world, projecting our meaning, and using language to survive the chaos. When you feel overwhelmed by that tidal wave of information, remember Husserl. Try to just bracket the noise, suspend your immediate judgment, look at what is actually there before you slap a label on it.
And definitely remember Heidegger.
Yes. Remember that you are completely thrown into this historical moment. You cannot escape your context. The intense anxiety you feel isn't a symptom of sickness. It's a symptom of being awake. It's proof that you are finally confronting the reality of your existence.
It totally transforms that anxiety from a bug in the software into a core feature.
Exactly. It's the very beginning of living an authentic life.
Here's a final thought for you to chew on as you go about your day. We talked about how Heidegger essentially believes that knowing is really just projecting our own meaning onto the world so we can survive. We name things to control them. So the real question is, when you look at the world around you, at the news feed, at your partner, at your daily job, do you ever really see them as they truly are? Or are you only ever seeing a reflection of your own needs, your own deep fears, and your own will to survive?
That really is the question.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll see you next time.